Continuing on in our language vein for a moment, I'd like to explore your following line. Quote, "This unfortunate reality does not match the rosy rhetoric from Western leaders." Now, the term rosy rhetoric itself uses rosy rhetoric through its alliteration. It appears again later in your book as rosy rhetoric was easy, successful transitions are hard. Again, rhetorical in its alliteration and contrast. The pro-democracy term Arab Spring is itself rosy rhetoric by your definition, rosy rhetoric of the would-be global democracy promoter, one might argue. A double-speak, life-giving metaphor for initial life-taking bloodshed. What's your take on the danger we face as communicators if, as appears to becoming a desirous trend, the art of rhetoric was nowhere to be found in political analysis and engagement? I would venture, for instance, your book would not be anywhere near as persuasive without the elegant appeals, beyond logical reason, to character and emotion that so enforce the heavy rhetorical firepower of your writing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I struggle with this a bit, too, in the sense that I'm, you know, in my professional life, I'm a political scientist. And political science is supposed to be neutral, supposed to be sort of, you know, this as scientific as possible. I don't think that it is a scientific discipline, as some people do. And I think that eliminating this aspect of it is creating a disservice to our expertise. Mm-hmm. In my view, you know, the ability to understand what's happening in the rest of the world requires a communication that involves values. Politics is fundamentally a values judgment. At the end of the day, why people have different political preferences does reflect their underlying values. So, you know, if you're going to make a political argument, I think it's important to use the right rhetoric to make the best appeal. I think, to be honest, I mean, you know, you can't use rosy rhetoric when it's a really bleak situation and just obscure the truth. But I think that pitching why you would do this, why you would make hard choices now to see some benefit later, I mean, to have some sterile language that's stripped of its rhetorical power is not persuasive. And fundamentally, I mean, this is the thing that's so interesting about this, is that the decline of democracy at the hands of misguided Western foreign policy is partly because Western foreign policy is being crafted in a democratic space. You have to convince people that it's worth it, right? There are not that many people who stand up and champion foreign aid anymore, right?
Absolutely.
It's a very easy punching bag. And I think rhetorically, you know, you need some of these stories to come through and say, you know, can you look this person in the eye and say that you getting two more Starbucks lattes a year is worth them rotting in a jail cell? Because at some point it does come down to that, right? That there's these very small programs that can actually make a huge difference in governance for millions of people around the world. And that message has been lost because there's nobody who's willing to communicate that way. And there's no one who's willing to just sort of say, look, let's stand up for this. And the people who are saying it in political science journals in a way that's inaccessible to the average voter. And that's part of the reason why I decided to write this book in a much more journalistic style and to pitch it as a trade book and for a trade audience, which would actually be in normal bookshops, because I don't think my audience for the book is political scientists. And some of them may look down on it for its sort of accessibility and they may mistake that, I think, for lack of rigor. But there are some hardcore political scientists who would say I had stepped over the line by being value-driven. And I think that defending democracy without defending values is impossible. I mean, I am pro-democracy, and I'm not going to pretend otherwise. And so, you know, to try to sort of contort this into a dispassionate, you know, sort of contorted prose, it was not my aim. And I wish more political scientists would speak out. And I think that that's actually something that's happening with the rise of populism and Donald Trump and xenophobia and things like that, where political scientists are finally finding their voice. And I hope they'll use powerful rhetorical language when they do, because there's this groundswell of expertise that has been untapped for the public. And I hope it comes out into the public view much more.
I'd like to quote from one of your principal descriptions in the book, if I may. Quote, "One of the annoying things about democracy is that other people often don't feel the same way that you do. Worse still, sometimes those people outnumber you. Democracy forces people with radically different opinions to coexist in the same society. In IR, that's an unavoidable problem. In order to truly support democracy, Western governments have to support the integrity of the electoral process. Even if it could result in a government that the West find abhorrent, reckless, and even terroristic." as an avid follower of your Twitter account. Discuss the election of Donald Trump in the context of that quote, please.
Good question. So I think that there is a parallel between free speech and democracy in the sense that free speech is meaningless unless unpopular speech is protected. And I think the same is true for democracy. The integrity of democracy is meaningless if unpopular outcomes can simply be reversed, right? Mm. I don't agree with the election of Donald Trump. I did not vote for him. I am appalled that he was elected president. Mm. But by the rules of American democracy, he's a legitimate president. And so to my view, there's a very fine line here that has to be drawn where you say, this doesn't mean that you think that Donald Trump has, you know, dictatorial powers for the next 4 years. This doesn't mean that he, because he got there and he followed the rules to get there, or well, largely followed the rules to get there, that he has, you know, this sort of magic wand for the next 4 years and he waves it and we just, you know, the dissent disappears. But at the same time, I think that democracy's strength is precisely in dissent. So, you know, this is where I find the U.S. and Western foreign policy can certainly weigh in on how they would like other governments to behave. Mm. They can weigh in on what might happen if governments do not behave that way. But meddling directly in their own elections, I think, is wrong. Mm. And so, you know, I think this is where people who had an objection to Obama saying that we'll put Britain at the back of the queue if Brexit is voted for example, mm-hmm. I think that's totally legitimate. It's a signal that we don't want this to happen, and we will impose consequences on you if you do. But they're not going to try to completely, you know, they're not going to fund the party that's, you know, going to be more pro-Remain. That I think would be something that would be a violation of the democratic integrity of the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's totally legitimate to signal there will be consequences to these things. It's totally legitimate to have dissent towards democratic outcomes. It's not legitimate to meddle in the process itself by which people are choosing. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the line I draw. And that's where I say, you know, people who try to say that Trump, you know, should be tossed out immediately, I don't actually agree with. I mean, I think if there was a clear grounds for impeachment, then absolutely. But I think that until we hit that point, you fight Donald Trump in sort of, you know, dissent, protest, activism, but you realize that he is the president of the United States, and that was the democratic will of the people according to the rules of American democracy. So it's not something I like, but I accept it.
You mentioned occasionally some elements of the research for this book and what you now see reflected in some of the actions of Donald Trump. To what extent do those two things marry, and you find Donald Trump despotic or dictator-like?
So there's several things where he is borrowing despotic techniques. I'm worried about Trump basically in regards to the book in two ways. One is that he is borrowing from some of the despots, as I said, that I mentioned in the book. Mm. The second is that he's making the world safer for despots. So the first one, you know, his attacks on the press, I've seen this around the world, his ability to blur fact and fiction, it's a key precursor to the creeping rise of authoritarianism. His attacks on independent authorities, you know, the sort of the gold standard of information in the past, his ability to have conflicts of interest with no consequence, the fact that he's circumventing the State Department and organizing meetings with his son-in-law. And these are types of things that I would expect to see in my research and not in my home country. So, you know, there's a lot of aspects, and beyond that, also his sort of outlandish claims without evidence of things like voter fraud, trying to get people to believe that American democracy is broken in a way that it's not. American democracy has serious problems, but that is not one of them, and he has no evidence for it. But yet, a recent poll showed a third of Americans believe that there is mass voter fraud. So these things are all strategies, you know, adapted to an American context that I've seen in authoritarian countries around the world. In terms of making the world safer for despots, I mean, the analogy I try to use now is, you know, the West used to be a biased referee. There was a game being played, and there was a biased referee calling the shots. So Saudi Arabia got away with a lot more penalties than a country like Madagascar, maybe. But, you know, there was a referee there. I think Donald Trump's not watching the game. And I think that that's the real change that we have in his election, is that there is no real moral authority in the West, whether it was perfect or not before, it at least existed. And that is going to accelerate the trends I highlight in the book of the decline of democracy globally. You know, Trump's State Department, for example, for the first time in I think a decade, The Secretary of State was not involved in the unveiling of the Human Rights Report. It's something that's a key aspect of what the State Department does. What kind of signal does that send, right? I mean, you know, and I was in Thailand a month ago, and the people there that I was interviewing were saying, we're just going to pitch ourselves as an ally in counterterrorism. I mean, Thailand has very little problem with terrorism. It's a low-level insurgency it has in the south. But they're going to try to link it to ISIS so that they can get, on Donald Trump's good side as a way to buy effectively a free pass on democracy and human rights. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's going to, unfortunately, be a successful strategy. And the more that it's successful one place, the more it will spread. So I think that basically, my call for optimism in the book is somewhat blunted by Trump's election and the inevitable acceleration of the decline of democracy that it will create. Mm.
Is it safe to assume that domestically the checks and balances will sort of help keep him in place, but foreign policy-wise will become much more of a sort of loose cannon problem?
Well, I think that foreign policy is something that the president gets to set much more unilaterally, so that's something that will shift much quicker. The checks and balances are under threat, though. I mean, I one of the things I've said repeatedly is I say, these documents, these checks and balances, both the institutions and the documents behind them are not magical in any way. Mm-hmm. They're as powerful as the people who uphold them when democracy is under threat. It's under threat right now. And many of the people who should be upholding democracy in a nonpartisan way are not doing that. So I think the rise of political polarization combined with the fact that many Republicans are unwilling to stand up to Trump on things that should be bipartisan, things like we value a free press, you cannot call the press the enemy of the American people, things like that where you really should have a bipartisan opposition to Trump, we're not seeing that. So I think, in 50 days, Donald Trump has done an enormous amount of damage to American democracy, and that doesn't mean that American democracy is dead, but it means that, we better keep an eye on it because, 50 days is what we have out of 1,460, right? So that's a long time to go. If it keeps up at this pace, I'm worried, especially if Republicans don't find a voice that says, we stand with you on certain policy ideas, but ideologically you have to constrain yourself into what is acceptable in the American democratic context and some of the things that you have done cross the line. And they did. So hopefully we'll see a little bit more of that pushback, but I'm very worried about it.
Your book, The Despot's Accomplice, ends on a note of hope for positive global democracy promotion. It was written, of course, before Donald Trump became president. Irrespective of the potential acceleration in the decline of democracy promotion brought about by Trump, what's your long-term position?
I think that I'm still hopeful for the long term. I'm pessimistic in the short term, but I think that there's this global crisis of democracy that could go one of two ways. Basically, it could go in the dark way where authoritarians and would-be authoritarianism sort of consolidate power, continue to peddle this sort of idea, we'll provide security, don't worry about your rights, or your freedoms, this type of idea. If that happens, the world's going to become more dangerous, it's going to become more volatile, it's going to be a much darker time for democracy. On the other hand, there may be a pushback to this where a lot of people are getting involved in politics that didn't care about it before. Trump actually is activating a part of America's population that was latent before in politics. If 2018 is a groundswell repudiation of Trump, American democracy could end up stronger than ever in the sense that, look, there's a backlash against this and that the democratic system won. The same is true across Europe, right? I mean, there could be a serious backlash against some of the overstepping of abusing democracy. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen, but I'm still optimistic over the long term because I think people, you cannot claim fake news when governance is really awful. I mean, when people suffer, they know they're suffering. People in Belarus know that the economy is bad. They know that they have no voice in government, and they're upset about it. That's where I think over the long term, eventually these sort of authoritarian regimes will be shown to be charlatans, and they'll eventually break down, and the world will become more democratic. But because of Trump and because of the rise of illiberal populism in Europe, I think that pace will be slowed. That's my pessimistic short take that has not undercut the overall optimism. Mm.
How do you evaluate the current institutional integrity of the West as an actor?
Well, that's the other major risk. If Russia gets its sort of wish list, which it has been recently in terms of, you know, European Union breaking down or at least being weakened, NATO being called into question, America in chaos, all these things that Russia would be delighted at. If the West splinters completely, we're in trouble, I think. You know, one of the things that I say, and I've said this a lot to sort of critics of me or my views, is, you know, the West, I am defending the West to a large point, even as I criticize them very strongly and very harshly, because I say, you know, imagine a world shaped by China or Russia, and it's not a world we're going to want to live in. It's not going to be the same type of values or freedoms or any sort of input. And I think that ultimately, again, just like democracy is the best of several bad options, the West is the best leader for the world of other bad options. So that doesn't mean that you cast the West out. It just means you try to work within the West to improve it and make sure it shapes the world in a more democratic fashion.
Dr. Brian Klass there, encouraging a positive approach to democracy promotion and to the West's involvement therein. In an interview that became ever more poignant in our editing room as the week's events unfolded. I closed out by asking Dr. Klass what 2017 has in store for him.
So I'm working on a book with my supervisor from Oxford, Professor Nick Cheeseman, who is now at the University of Birmingham. The book is called How to Rig an Election. So it'll be our sort of catalog of all the different electoral hijinks we've encountered across the world. He particularly focuses in Africa. I'll bring some African examples, some Southeast Asia, Middle East, et cetera, Eastern Europe to the table. I'm also working, I'm writing a biweekly column for the Washington Post in a project they have called Democracy Post, which is a focus on global democracy. So that's taking up a lot of time, but it's a really rewarding project. And beyond that, I'm teaching at the LSE and occasionally giving my thoughts on the airwaves. So that's the plan for the foreseeable future. And maybe a bit more field research in the future, because it's something that I just find myself gravitating towards. I just don't think I can comment intelligently on some of these topics if I haven't been to the places and spoken to the people who are actually fighting the battles I write about.
Dr. Brian Klass, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Until next time then, I'm Michael L. Roberts. I was joined by Dr. Brian Klass for this fourth installment of Arguendo, a 12th Pier Productions Program 2017, with music by Chris Ward.